On January 16, 2009, before a packed house at Mount Vernon Washington High School, Dr. Ernest Tutt of Skagit Valley College spoke to the question, why is Barack Obama black? Whiteness and the co-creation of the other.
We are at a moment in our history where I think, because of that dual racial identity of Barack Obama, that it offers us an entree like never before to discuss the issue of race. And I want to try and do it from a different angle this time by looking at whiteness. Let's get started with it. Why did I choose that? Why is Obama black? The story behind this, I'm driving to work, and this was back about a year ago, February, and this was one of the early primaries or caucuses, and Carl Castle on NPR, you know, with that deep, robust voice comes on and he's doing the announcement, he's giving the results of one of the primaries, and at the end he says, if elected, Barack Obama would be the first black president of the United States. I tell you, I nearly drove off the road. Because how could someone responsible for being informed and informing us be so ill-informed? Everybody knows that Bill Clinton was the first African-American president. Everybody knows that. Immediately after I had that little chuckle, too, a couple of other thoughts came into my mind. I think, number one, the comment stood out to me as something that was kind of grossly overstated. It was one of those where you go, duh, afterwards. Secondly, I thought it was a bit premature. You know, here it was February. We had at least 8 months to go, and that's highly premature. But the third thought that popped into my mind was, why is Obama black? Why is Barack Obama black? Now, on the way to class, I was inspired to ask my students that same question. I learned not to ask them those questions at 7:30 in the morning, but I asked them, why is Barack Obama black? And they looked at me much in the way that you're looking at me now, like Dr. Tutt isn't the as plain as the rather broad nose on his face, his full lips, his skin coloration, it's rather obvious, isn't it? And we all agreed that it was indicative of an African-American. One of the students raised her hand and said, doesn't he self-identify as black? And we all agreed that he did. And even though politicians are prone to exaggerate and stretch the truth, if the man says he's black, I guess you got to take him at his word. But for some reason, it didn't quite satisfy me. I know it keeps down on a lot of the confusion in the Obama household, but for me, I started thinking back to my basic biology. You know, when I was in school, and I guess it hasn't changed since then, we were taught that when the sperm, we're talking procreation here, so, when the sperm and the zygote meet to form the gamete, that gamete inherits half of its genetic material from its mother and the other half of its genetic material from its father. We all know that, right? So in the case of Barack Obama, whose mother was a white woman from Kansas and father was an African who was in the States studying, we would conclude from that, understanding genetics, that Barack Obama is as white as he is black. Is he not? Genetically speaking. Now, granted, he has inherited some of the dominant characteristics of his father that are obvious and apparent to us, but that doesn't preclude the fact that he has also, without a doubt, inherited some dominant characteristics, perhaps not as visible, from his mother as well. And the whole notion of dominance and recessive, we kind of get confused. We think the dominant genes are like eating up the recessive genes, and they're not. And that's not the case. The recessive genes are there, and they are influencing just as well, because if they were not, Barack Obama would be what we call, back home in the Deep South, Urpal. That doesn't mean anything to you. See, I know, that's a regional thing there. Urpal is that color, you know? Urpal is like black and purple together, and as kids we used to call, ooh, dude, you're Urpal. Now, couple that, knowing what we know about genetics, couple that with the fact that for the most part of his life, He was reared by his maternal grandparents, most of all his grandmother, whom he speaks adoringly or spoke adoringly of all through the campaign. It could be argued then that Obama is indeed ethnically more white than he is black. Thus, the spate of newspaper articles by African Americans who actually question whether or not Obama was in fact black enough. You remember that period? Yeah. Was he black enough? Was he in touch with the black experience having graduated from Harvard? It was then that it occurred to me that perhaps I was asking myself the wrong question. Instead of asking, why is Obama black, perhaps the more poignant question, and definitely the more provocative question, as evidenced by your presence here today, why is Obama not white? But as you can see, we couldn't fit that on the poster, and so we left it just like it was there, so we stayed with the other. Why is he not white? Well, there's a long and a short question or answer to that. The long answer is this presentation. The short answer is the fact that customarily and legally in this country, up until the 2000 census, it was appropriate for a person of mixed racial descent to identify himself according to his non or her non-white parent. Not their paternal lineage, not their maternal lineage, which is customarily the way that we do things, but by their non-white parent. Now, to understand why that is, we have to analyze the concept of whiteness. Now, right off the bat, I'll bet you you're feeling a little, there's a little cognitive dissonance going on right now. What in the world are we doing sitting here looking at this short, bedreaded black guy talk to us about whiteness? And no less, on a day when we are commemorating the life and accomplishments of Dr. Martin Luther King, what do they have to do with anything? Well, the point that I want to make to you is that it is only against the backdrop of whiteness that color, race, and ethnicity actually become visible when you think about it. Now, a moment ago, I had a black screen up there. If I had not drawn your attention to it, you would have not paid any attention to it at all, because frankly, there was nothing to see. That's what we think, right? But the minute that I put the colored letters there, it drew your attention because it stood out from the normative background of white. Isn't that the way we think about race? When we think of color, ethnicity, and race, we think of Native Americans, we think of African Americans, we think of Asians, and whiteness becomes invisible. It takes on the background. I was talking to a colleague a moment ago who are calling all colors, a white student calling all colors, but could not see his place in calling all colors. Well, you too are color. This, in many ways, demonstrates that even though it is a dominant ethnicity, it is nothing more. It is not the normative ethnicity to which everything else should be compared to. And I quote from one of the founders of whiteness studies, Ruth Frankenberg, who wrote the book White Women, Race Matters, The Social Construction of Whiteness. She says that naming whiteness displaces it from the unmarked, unnamed status. To speak of whiteness is, I think, to finally assign everyone a place in the relations of race. And I think that that is a very appropriate quote for tonight. And that's one of the reasons why I think we should talk about whiteness. Another reason, it has to do with this quote by Haile Selassie. This was delivered 2 months after the March on Washington, when King did the I Have a Dream speech. You're probably familiar with this if you've ever listened to Bob Marley. His song, he titles this War, but the saying goes, "Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned, until there are no longer first-class and second-class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, and until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, until that day, the dream of lasting peace world citizenship and the rule of international morality will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never obtained. Now, the points that I want to bring out to legitimize my presentation tonight, let me first of all start off with stanza number 2 and number 3. This points to, I think this whole statement points to the dual mission of civil rights. 2 and 4 point to the eradication of injustice and inequality based on race. We can see that very clearly. And that was what was embraced by the civil rights movement, and rightfully so. It was the most immediate need at that time to alleviate these inequalities based on race. But in embracing that mission, in many ways, we conceded the even greater mission, which is embedded in number 1 and number 3. You see, by focusing on the inequalities of race, we inadvertently conceded race itself. We don't question race, it's a given. What we focus on are the problems associated with race. We look at discrimination, but we don't call into question the legitimacy of this socially constructed idea that we call race at all. And until we do, then we will always have these problems. And so, therefore, I thought it would be appropriate tonight to use this topic of whiteness and the co-creation of the other, which will obviously be explained as we get further into it. So let me start off by defining whiteness, which is not an easy thing to do. And this is a new field of study. As I mentioned, it's only about a decade. So go home and try and Google whiteness. You might find whiteness studies, which will explain the field of research dealing with whiteness. You might find definitions related to the color, which are good. And I brought those with me because I think they will give us some insight into whiteness itself. Let's look at the first one here. Lightness, or fairness of complexion, the quality or state of achromatic color of the greatest lightness. The key is this last bit. Bearing the least resemblance to black, we will find, as at the origin of this concept of whiteness, that that is how it is defined. We don't know exactly what white is, but we do know that it isn't black. So it was defined in opposition to something rather than defining itself. Another definition: purity, the state of being unsullied by sin or moral wrong, lacking a knowledge of evil. One out of two ain't bad. So I started concocting my own, and you know about those working definitions. They do tend to be rather long and wordy. So the socially constructed ideologies, norms, and practices that constitute the collective racial identity and life experience of people of Anglo-European descent as a dominant ethnic culture in the modern world. One, yeah, that's what I said. Shh, that's a lot. So let me give you one more, and I think this is succinct. The taken for granted, a little more political, but the taken for granted embedded and articulated set of normative cultural practices created to serve, protect, and enhance the interest of white people. We can work with that? All right. Okay, good. Let's move ahead. Now, it is my contention, and this is what I want to put forth tonight, that just like any socially constructed idea, whiteness has evolved, just as blackness has evolved. I mean, we came from nigger to negro to colored to, let me get these in some order here, black, then Afro-American. It was confusing growing up as a black kid because we went back Afro-American, then we went African-American, and now we're back to black again. So the same thing, and I would prescribe that for whiteness, we're going to look at 4 periods, and I borrow this idea from Matthew Jacobson, who has written a real interesting book called Whiteness of a Different Color, and it explores the assimilation of white ethnic groups, the Irish, the Jews, the Germans, who came and tried to assimilate into the Anglo-Saxon core, which we'll look at too. And it's a whole unique set of experiences. The first phase I'd like to talk about here in just a moment is called the classical, get that word right, circumscription. This is the original period when the Europeans began to kind of define themselves against the other, when they first used science to interpret the variations in skin color and the like throughout the world, and we'll talk extensively about that. The second would be the continental conservation. That is when the whole idea of race itself was imported to the Western world. Now, we're not going to focus on South America or Central America. We're just going to focus on North America. And the next would be the fragmentation and reconciliation stage, which will be rather interesting. I'm going to go out on a limb and make some speculations on there. But I'm saying that in this period of time in the United States, there was a schism or a rift in the ideology of whiteness, most apparent in the Civil War. And then the last one, there was a reconciliation period afterwards. And then finally, we come to this period of a pan-ethnic consolidation, which is, in my mind, kind of where we are now. And perhaps what we might be leaving, I'm not sure. And I hope to kind of open the floor up for discussion about that as to exactly what is this phase of whiteness, with taking into consideration the election of Barack Obama recently. Does this mean something different for whiteness? So, looking at our first, the classical circumscription, we're talking about the third century of European colonialism. We're talking about the Age of Enlightenment, the rise of modern empirical science. And this empirical science not only provided a method by which Europeans were able to analyze these things that we would later call race, but it also legitimized the notion of race, and in particular, the Eurocentric notions of race, which we will see. So to start off with, as I always tell my students, we got to begin with a little theory. I know, but we got to begin with a little theory. And these are a couple of theories, two main theories that deal with the human species origin and migration. We've got two large camps. One is called a polygenesis, which believes that there are multiple genesis of the human species, and we'll talk about that, as opposed to the monogenesis, meaning that there is one single origin, which most religions adhere to. So the polygenesis theory proposes for us that about 2 million years ago, as it says here, you can read along, 2 million years ago, an early hominid, Homo erectus, left Africa. Now, both of these theories recognize Africa as the place of human origin. Another question that we could toss out during the dialogue, what does that mean? What does that mean to fully embrace the idea that all life began in Africa? Peter Tosh had a song called, the lyrics went, "Don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you are an African." Well, we could change those lyrics and still be just as true. Don't care where you come from, as long as you are a human, you are an African. But what does it mean to fully embrace that idea? 2 million years ago, Homo erectus leaves, and they move to different regions of the old world, Indonesia, Europe, Asia. And there, in semi-isolation, with just enough gene interaction, that's what those dotted lines represent, to prevent speciation, to keep us, or so long as we interacted there, we could always interbreed. So we weren't just totally isolated, but you can see where this kind of thinking leads. It leads to the notion of pure races, more so than it does a single race. Their idea of how race actually came about was through natural selection. The strongest, the fittest, survived. And then human beings also made choices about who they would mate with and who they would marry. First theory. Theory number two. This is perhaps a more widely accepted theory, and it is the recent single origin theory. Again, it agrees that all life began in Africa, but Homo erectus actually did leave probably about 1.4 million years ago. It went to Asia, but then it died out. It was succeeded by another series. In fact, as we talk here, at least four species of hominids evolved and migrated out of Africa in successive waves, with the last being the Homo sapiens up here at the top. And the Homo sapiens, unlike all the others, were the first to spread over all the known world. interesting point here, that variance of race, the notion of race, is actually only 50,000 years old, and it was caused by genetic mutation as we migrated from this central point here. And as we can see, the tropical regions, darker skinned people, and as we migrated north, needing more sunlight to process vitamin D, because without that you are not a healthy person, and women don't bear children without the folic acid that's also produced with vitamin D. Thus we get the skin coloration. The first person to really kind of look at this and analyze this notion of the variation was one of the early naturalists. His name was Georges Louis Leclerc de Buffon. Yes. And he observed that despite similar environments, different regions have distinct plants and animals. And his conclusion was climate change facilitated the worldwide spread of species from a central place of origin. We can see a little bit of Judeo-Christian belief in there, so we've got that Garden of Eden thing. But here's the key. In this spread, species have both improved and degenerated. Not changed to adapt to their surroundings, but improved and degenerated. Now, to me, I always put this to remind myself, it was the first crooked plank in the construction of race. Okay, and the social construction. So keep in mind this notion of improvement and degeneration, because it will play a role in our understanding of race. A contemporary of Leclerc was this gentleman, Carolus Linnaeus. If you ever hated biology because you had to remember all of this, you know, the kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, this is the guy who's responsible for that. Yeah. And he called that his binomial nomenclature. Considered one of the brightest minds of his time. In my research, came across Goethe and Rousseau, and I can't remember which one of those quoted. They said, if God created, Linnaeus organized. That was the quote. And they actually gave him a nickname. They call him the second Adam, because he went through this process of naming just about everything he encountered. And what he concluded was that human beings are members of the same family, so he would be more one of the monogenesis, whatever we would call him. And we come from the Animalia chordata, meaning we've got a spinal cord, mammalia, primates, hominid, Homo sapien. He went one step further, though. Good Europeans, they won't leave well enough alone. He actually was the first person to come up with the classification of races, and he classified them using the Latin term. And some points that I really want you to pay attention to: Americanus, these are the Native Americans; Asiatus, obviously Asians; Africans, and Europeus. Reddish color refers to their skin color. Caloric, obviously their emotional state. Caloric meaning they're temperamental people. Just okay? Key also is this part, regulated by customs. We'll come back to that. This will have incredible meaning. You'll see how this plays an important role in U.S. Immigration policy much later. Second is Asiatus, sallow, yellow, melancholy. Yeah. Ruled by opinions. Mm-hmm. Africanus, black, phlegmatic. That's phlegmatic, you know, just dull, not no brain. But of course, when he gets to the Europeans, white, sanguine, muscular, hair long, flowing, eyes blue, gentle, acute, inventive, covers himself with clothes, vestments, governed by laws. Laws representing the highest form of reason. And later on in America, what this little phrase here, governed by laws, free whites, yes, but also self-governable. And obviously, he has laid the groundwork so that these people could not be admitted, because they are not self-governable. They're regulated by customs, habit. They're regulated by opinions, which might be here today, gone tomorrow, right? They're regulated by caprice, just whatever, whichever the wind blows, I'm interested. It is only the European there who are governed by laws. Very much a Eurocentric perspective. Ah, this is the one that we're probably most familiar with, Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, first gentleman to coin the phrase Caucasian. And he coined that phrase because not only, now you got to understand, this is a guy, he's working with skulls. Okay, and this is what he's doing his research with a lot of skulls that he's collected. And he thought that the most beautiful skulls came from those people from the region of Asia Minor. He also thought that was because that was the place where Noah's Ark came to rest. So showing you the graph here, here we have Mount Ararat, where the Bible tells us that the Ark came to rest, right? And so his theory was that it was from that area that all migration began, and particular interest with these folks who went into the Caucasus region and then later moved up into northern and western into Europe. So the Caucasian race, he was the one to give that name. In his first book, published in 1775, was there something else going on around then, 1775? This small fracas someplace, yeah. So you think maybe people in this country were maybe reading a little of that? You betcha they were. When he first wrote his book in 1775, he didn't bother to hierarchically arrange any of these. He just simply offered a description. These are these people. And he came up with these terms, Caucasian, Mongolian, Ethiopian, American, and Malay. So he added one more than Carolus Linnaeus. But obviously, some of his European colleagues persuaded him to come back and rewrite that book. He publishes again in 1795, some 20 years later. He presents his Blumenbach's Geometry of Human Order. And this little pyramid is that geometry. And lo and behold, what is at the top? Yes, Europeans. Down below, the Malays and the Americans. Native Americans got kicked up the rung there, according to... And at the bottom, we have the Ethiopians and the Mongolians bringing up. So this hierarchical structure is what we began to use to consider people of different skin colors. He then went on to add, and here again, we can see the influence of, once again, yes, of Leclerc. White, we may fairly assume, to be the primitive. So he turns the whole thing on its head. Life no longer begins in Africa. It begins there in that Caucasus region. And so it's no longer even the case. And so white being the primitive color of mankind, since it is easy to degenerate into brown, but very much more difficult for dark to become white. White is on the ascension. Dark represents the degradation. Final person we want to look at during this period is a gentleman named Georges Cuvier, and he is the one that we, when I grew up in school, these were the great races that we learned about, the big three, Caucasian, Mongol, and Negro. And again, the same Leclerc influence there, the white race with oval face, straight hair and nose, to which the civilized people of Europe belong, and which appear to us the most beautiful of all, is also superior to others by its genius, courage, and activity. So what we get from this is a social construction of race. And what we mean by that is that in observing the phenotypes, the objective physical characteristics, the genetic expression in terms of body build, skin color, hair texture, facial features, that wasn't enough. What we had to do was attach to that subjective meanings. Subjective meanings about mental capacity, physical ability, civility, evolutionary development, beauty, emotional state. And what happened with those is that over time, and this is the way, we create reality. Symbolic interactionism says that human beings create meaning. And in acting upon those meanings, they create reality. And so what happens over a period of time is that those subjective meanings become just as essential as those characteristics. And so this is the beginning of the social construction of race. And so now when we see these physical characteristics, we can actually summarize this. This is the summary of what we learn from that classical period, that human beings can be classified according to their physical characteristics. Number two, that the outer physical characteristics are markers for internal qualities and behaviors and behavioral tendencies. These qualities are essential fixed, unalterable, and distinct. They are also qualities that are inheritable. And human variation is hierarchical, with obviously the Europeans at the top. Now, I could present quite a few arguments to disprove that, but I thought this would be the most eloquent because since they use science to legitimize their arguments, thankfully science later on through genetics has redeemed itself. And what we see here is that even though they saw a great difference in these individuals, out of the 3 billion human base pairs of DNA, there is only 0.2% difference between any human being on the earth. 0.2% different. We are, in fact, the most similar species, or one of the most similar species on the face of the earth. And here's what's even more, is that when you begin to look at the 0.2%, 85% of that small 0.2% is within ethnic groups. So there is greater genetic variety within the white race, if we want to use that word, than there is genetic difference between blacks and whites. As we can see, which is that little percentage right there, only 6% of that 0.2% of the difference between races. And as they say here, that's why for black Americans, white Americans can actually be a better donor than African Americans in many cases because of that genetic similarity.
Stay tuned for the remainder of Ernest Tutt's exploration of race, racism, and racial identity.
We move into the continental conservation period, and this is where I was telling you, where we began to define more and more whiteness in terms of opposition. Also, whiteness becomes a property right. It becomes a badge, a merit, something to be achieved by ethnic Europeans and who come to this country. But it isn't just given away. You really have to earn this. The only people who really didn't have to worry about that were the Anglo-Saxon core. So we'll look at a little bit of that period. But really, the first white neighborhood in America, you know, and they put themselves right there on Jamestown, the Virginia Company. Of course, we know the story. They settle in territory that nobody wants. I mean, the natives have been there for centuries, but they didn't settle in that swampy area. You know, they knew better with the mosquitoes and everything. But they settle right there in the middle of this 30-tribe confederacy called the Powhatan. And we get the story, you know, Pocahontas and John Smith and the like. And you would think that being right there in the middle of Native American country, that that would be a big concern. And it was. It was a concern. But that wasn't their only concern. They were also concerned about the common unity between poor blacks and indentured whites. That was a big concern. And that came to fruition in 1675 and 1676 with Bacon's Rebellion. And as you can see there, he joined together both black and white indentured servants. Now, he was a little off his rocker, as some people would say, and he was interested in going out and taking the land from the Indians, and he was frustrated that the government wouldn't let him do that. But the big fear that they had, and you will see this occur again, is this notion of poor blacks and whites, poor people uniting against the elitists. So slavery was implemented strategically to minimize the differences between poor whites and wealthy whites while magnifying the difference between whites and blacks. But it didn't stop there. Love this quote. Slavery alone did not solve the problem of white servants making common cause with their black counterparts. The potential for class antagonism between whites remained. The answer to the problem, obvious if unspoken, and only gradually recognized, was racism. The intent was now to develop an ideology that would separate dangerous free whites from dangerous blacks by a screen of racial contempt. We can see that and perhaps the greatest Virginian of all, Thomas Jefferson. And we were talking about whether or not the writings are of Blumenbach influenced people. And this is that famous quote that he gives. "I advance it, therefore, as a suspicion only, that the blacks, whether originally a distinct race or made distinct by time and circumstances, are inferior to whites in the endowments of both body and mind. This unfortunate difference of color and perhaps of faculty is a powerful obstacle to the emancipation of these people." So that further drove that wedge. No matter how poor you were as a white person, you could always be better than a black person. And so that was ingrained, and whiteness became a property right. Another of our founding fathers, and I hope I'm not disturbing anybody by kind of, this is not revisionist history, it is there to be found. It may be buried in the books that we don't look to find, but it is there. George Washington, Benjamin Franklin not only had a problem, he had a fundamental problem with bringing slaves over in the first place. And I don't know if that had to do with the, as he says here, messing up or destroying the sanctity of whiteness per se, or if he really had an ideological disagreement with slavery altogether. But he had also concerns about other Europeans, as we see here. The number of purely white people in the world is proportionably very small. All Africa is black or tawny. Asia chiefly tawny. America exclusive of the newcomers, wholly so. And this is, I love this. And in Europe, the Spaniards, Italians, French, Russians, and Swedes are generally of what we call a swarthy complexion. Yeah? As are the Germans. Any of those nationalities here? Okay. Only the Saxons only excepted, who with the English make the principal body of white people on the face of the earth. I would wish their numbers were increased. Why should we, in the sight of superior beings, darken its people? Why increase the sons of Africa by planting them in America, where we have so fair an opportunity, by excluding all blacks and tawnies, of increasing the lovely white and red? And he wasn't talking about Native Americans there. Yeah, okay, he was talking about that sanguine complexion that, you know, that Linnaeus was talking about. But perhaps I'm partial to the complexion of my country, for such kind of partiality is natural to mankind. So these notions definitely played a role in our founding fathers. Now, someone who totally disagreed with that and who saw this as a wonderful thing was a gentleman, J. Hector Crevasseur. And he wrote one of the most popular series of books in early American. This was probably the first bestseller, Letters from an American Farmer. And he writes this wonderful glowing, because he has a different vision. Whereas Franklin sees it as the degradation, he sees it as a wonderful opportunity. Whence came all these people? They are a mixture of English, Scotch, Irish, French, Dutch, Germans, and Swedes. From this promiscuous breed, that race now called Americans has arisen, a race called Americans. The Americans were once scattered all over Europe. Here they are incorporated into one of the finest systems of population which has ever appeared and which will hereafter become distinct by the power of the different climates they inhabit. Leclerc, once again, you know, because he thought that's the reason for all the different species. So we get to see this run all the way through. It was interesting doing the research on this. So that brings us to the end of that period. And we enter in with this kind of schism represented by Crevasseur and Franklin over the value of the white ethnic groups who were coming to it. Was it a good thing? Was it a bad thing? And that argument was never quite settled. So we move into a period of fragmentation and reconciliation, and I use the term a white house divided to talk about this notion. Here's where I step out on a limb. I borrow from Broad and Kaufman's theorizing masculinities because it struck me really peculiar that I never found any women writing about race. It seemed to be a male thing. And I understand the gender issue and what women were allowed to do during a period of time, but it seems strange that in the whole study of race from 1600 on, I haven't found a single woman. So it seems to be a masculine thing. So I borrowed from this. They say that in America, there are in general three different types of masculinities, three different types of manhood. Now, I want to extrapolate and expand on that and suggest that they also represent three separate definitions of whiteness. The first one, the genteel patriarch, which was the southerner, rural, landowner class, refined, elegant proponent of slavery. You have the heroic artisan. When we think of Paul Revere, that's what we think of there. The heroic artisan, northern, urban, yeoman farmer, independent craftsman. His ideas about slavery, he is either ambivalent or adamant about the abolition of slavery. Now, these two gentlemen lived in kind of a symbiotic balance for a while. They tolerated each other very well. You know, you do your thing, and I'll do my thing. Until, in many ways, marketplace, what they call marketplace man came. And this is what we call the American everyman. He's a capitalist. He's restless, opportunistic, aggressive, and competitive. Now, here is where I go out on a limb. It's my conjecture that the first two are in competition for political power. The other is interested in making money. What he wants to subdue is this. He wants to subdue the rest of this. While the North and South are just squabbling over states' rights and slavery, I want to go make some money, basically. I want to secure some property. But he couldn't do that until the genteel patriarch and the artisan settled the issue of slavery. And that came about through the Civil War. Into this tinderbox of tension walks John Brown. There we go, the classic picture. And once again, what does John Brown represent? That iconic fear of most Americans. He was the person who unified poor blacks and poor whites in the common cause of slavery. And we can see here the genteel patriot from the South, a patriarch, and then the heroic artisan here, with John Brown right there in the middle. And in many ways, I don't know that I would go to this extent, but this is an inter-ethnic schism. You agree? I mean, even though they aren't fighting necessarily over ethnic differences, we do have to realize this is the war that had the most casualties in American history. We're talking about 600,000 people dying. We're talking about Jew fighting Jew. We're talking German fighting Jew. We're talking Italian fighting Irish. We're talking brother fighting brother. So in many ways it was, even though the issues weren't revolving around ethnicity, it was an inter-ethnic struggle. What brought this to an end was that opening of the West and the ascendancy of the marketplace whiteness, which went westward. Manifest Destiny, which has as its premises the obvious certainty of the virtue of the American people and their institutions. The mission to spread these institutions, thereby redeeming and remaking the world in the image of the U.S., and the final plank of Manifest Destiny, which is that it was ordained by God. And I can't think of a better icon than this. And this is the famous painting by John Gast, American Progress. We see in the background here how light it is, and here in that foreboding darkness of the frontier, we have the white angel representing God's blessing. And look at we've got technology, we've got the train, we've got the ships and the boats, we've got agriculture. And in the advance of this, we have the poor natives fleeing, and all nature actually getting the hell out of there, really. Because look what's coming, yeah? Also, I'd like to show another icon, which I think exemplifies the kind of fragile reconciliation between the North and the South, between the genteel patriarch and the historic artisan. And that had to do, but this also represents the ascendancy of a marketplace man, because this is what he wanted to do. Remember this famous picture? You know the story behind it. Okay, so you've got the Union Pacific coming from the East, primarily Irish, other Europeans, but primarily Irish. You've got the Central Pacific coming from the West, primarily Chinese. Can you find a Chinese worker in this picture? Nope. Why? Because they were banned from the ceremonies. They were excluded from the ceremonies. So we see, once again, marketplace man, defining himself in opposition, using exclusion to define himself. So we move into the last phase, which I want to kind of conclude with, which I call the pan-ethnic consolidation, the exclusion and ethnogenesis. Ethnogenesis is a term that we use. It usually describes when minority groups kind of come together because they are bonding together because of common discrimination, because of common oppression. Well, majority groups can do the same thing, and that's what many, what happened to the white ethnic groups. They formed what I call the Caucasian monolith. You know, let's do away with all the ethnic barriers that kept us apart. The Judaism, the German, we can become one solid group of people, one solid race, and that was the Caucasian monolith. And we see the expectation of white privilege begin to arise, which we'll talk about very briefly. A couple of interesting cases that went down in the early 1900s that really solidified. So what we're doing is we're consolidating the race through excluding all others. First case. Takao Ozawa versus the United States, 1922. Japanese citizen, had been in the country for a number of years, actually went to Berkeley, got a college degree, had a family, had a business. He petitioned for citizenship. The Supreme Court, case went all the way to the Supreme Court. For the life of me, I cannot think of the judge right now, but he heard both of these cases. The case relied on Linnaeus. See, I mean, here we are in 1922, and we're still basing our decisions on race based on Blumenbach, based on Linnaeus. And so the court found that only Caucasians were white, and therefore Japanese, by not being Caucasian, but of the Mongoloid race, were not white, and instead were members of an inassimilable race. Remember, because the Japanese, they were ruled by opinion. Not governable, self-governable. So they were excluded. So they use science to exclude this gentleman from citizenship. Now, 2 years or 1 year later, Bhagat Singh, he must have been reading the papers, obviously, because he saw his opportunity. He says, well, hey, if there's ever been a Caucasian, I'm it, because I was raised in Turkey. I mean, I'm right there in the Caucasus mountain range. I am a real Caucasian. And so he petitions, and the court says, then was not a white person, as used in the common speech, to be interpreted in accordance with the understanding of common man. I mean, that's circumlocution if I've ever heard it. But they finally came up with, which I just find, although all whites were considered Caucasians, all Caucasians were not necessarily considered white. So obviously he didn't get admitted. And so what we see, once again, is the consolidation through exclusion. And the reason that I say that this was a period of consolidation was because of this. I think this represented at some point, I mean, we're looking at the first non-WASP to be elected as President of the United States. Here we are in a different time, revisiting that same opportunity, which we thought this was just the greatest era, and it was probably turned out to be the most painful era in the history of our nation, well, at least in modern times. I assume that the Civil War was obviously painful for the people of that period as well. There was also an ugly side to this consolidation as well. We want white tenants in our white communities. Some people were bold enough to put that out in the yards. Other people had those covenants that you didn't know about, but when you applied or tried to buy a home, that you couldn't have them. And so consolidation by fear. And consolidation meant fear, created fear, not just in the part of minorities, but also on the part of whites themselves. And this is what I think is most important to look at. Speaking of fear, had to throw that one in there. I'm sure many of you saw this one when it came out. Kind of took me aback at first. After reading what the gentleman was trying to do, he was really poking fun at us and saying, you know, this is the politics of fear. It wasn't intended to be what I initially thought it was. But I wanted to look at this real quickly, this unified theory of ethnic relations. What has happened in this exclusionary exercise by defining ourselves, or whiteness defining itself in opposition to everyone else? What it's done, it's take some very identifiable and distinctive characteristics size of a population, the resources that they bring to the country, sociocultural, the language, religion, and even the biological, all of that we could kind of sum up and say as not white. And it is the non-whiteness that threatens the majority ethnic community. And what happens with that is that that breeds negative beliefs and stereotypes. Those stereotypes convert into discriminatory treatment, which we saw in that sign just a moment ago. That creates a stratification of social resources. When you are discriminated against, we're talking about access to social resources. And you then begin to see how the cycle repeats itself. Because when you're stratified and have limited resources, it makes you even more identifiable. You get me? Because you're hanging out with the same people, you're eating the same food, you're dressing the same way, and so it just perpetuates the cycle over and over and over. And thus we get the cycle of poverty and the cycle of discrimination that is hard to overcome. And in my class, the textbook that I use talks about incorporating egalitarian values. That's the only thing that can change us. And we do have some very clear egalitarian values that are in our founding documents. But I wanted to find out, since this creates the sense of threat, what could we do? What other emotion could we generate through these egalitarian values? And I went looking for a synonym for threat. That's about as easy as finding a definition for whiteness sometimes. But the definition of threat, synonyms, warning, menace, intimidation, danger, risk, hazard, peril, I wanted to find an antonym, and that's what I came up with. And I thought, how poetic, you know, promise. Instead of seeing a threat, I see a promise. Promise being defined as an assurance, an undertaking. Or more importantly, the latter part down here, potential, possibilities, capacity, aptitude, talent, and ability. So changing the perspective and not seeing the other in opposition, but seeing him as the same, because that's the way we do things. I mean, we call this social identity theory. The way that we discover about ourselves as human beings is through social comparison. The way that I found out that I was a boy was to find out that, oh, you're a girl. And we continue. And that's how men define themselves, do we not?
Not woman.
And women?
Not man.
You know? So we define ourselves in opposition. And it's a very difficult thing to overcome, but that's what we are capable of doing as human beings, I certainly hope. The ability to see ourselves in the other, that's what we're wanting to be able to do. And I think and am hoping that this recent election really represents that, that we've come to a point, a new stage, where we actually can see in the other individual ourselves. And I want to make it clear. I know I've kind of joked and pointed and poked fun at whiteness, but all through the history of America, there have also been white allies. A Dr. King, if he were standing here today, would tell you that there is no way that the civil rights movement would have been as effective as it was without white allies. And you can go back to the beginning of American history and trace it all the way down, and there has always been the presence of enlightened white people who were able to see promise in people who did not look exactly like them. And I'm so grateful and thankful for those. I know in my personal life, I would not be where I am because of, in particular, white men who saw promise in me. And even though I was fatherless and being raised by a single mom, came to my neighborhood and took me to places, got me involved in public speaking, a talent that I didn't even know about. And so I honor that by being here tonight. And this is what we need more of, white allies. So to kind of wrap things up and get to the dialogue, and defining again, whiteness then is a story of a people who in constructing their own narrative identity have simultaneously deconstructed, marginalized, and in many instances, and I must tell you, I struggle over the word many. I can't tell you how many times I deleted many and put some, you know, but I finally wound up with many because when I look over it, many is accurate. So in many instances, done violence to the narratives of other peoples. Because they could not see the other which they created. We didn't create ourselves as others. We were interpreted as being something different. The blue pill or the red pill? And here is where we open it up kind of for dialogue, because I was curious about what's up ahead. You know, these are some statistics that, and I have some other slides that we can use here. Current demographic data for the state of Washington. We are unique in this state, are we not? Very unique, with 76% white population and very little people of color to speak of there, but growing. But this is what's changing. You can see the ratio of white people to people of color in consecutive age groups based on 2000 census. We start over here, anyone 80, wow, that was a period. That was a period of white dominance, white supremacy. For every one person of color, there was almost eight. And so you can move further down here. This is about my age group. Oh, just let the cat out of the bag, didn't I? So one, two, about three. And now, look at, these are your children. These are your grandchildren. Look at the ratios that they're, the kind of thinking about race that we have maintained will no longer work in an environment where it is one to two or one to one. And of course, we've seen all of these changing demographics where the white non-Hispanic, interesting concept there too, white non-Hispanic. Isn't that confusing? And what it is simply separating those Hispanic people who would identify themselves as white. And so in some area, we are still kind of defining ourselves in opposition. I keep saying we. Okay. To remind myself of that. But we're beginning to see these other groups, and so what we're looking at is a bare majority. And so once again, those ideologies about race, can they continue to exist in this country with demographic changes being such? Now I'd like to conclude with this one thought by Dr. King. We are caught in an unescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly.
The distribution of this program is made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.